DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. On today's programme, turning point. Could the retaking of Kherson really be Ukraine's D-Day moment? Looking ahead, inside Lviv's extraordinary bid to become European youth capital. Plus, homes for Ukraine. The UK's hosting scheme is in serious trouble.
Even if by the end of this year they can't basically be somewhere, we're not going to kick them out, but we will try to re-emphasize that we're expecting you to start earning money, looking for a place. And I think that needs to be a very clear message what the expectations are from each side.
Those stories and more coming up on the programme.
Я хочу, щоб ця агресивна російська війна закінчилась справедливо і на основі.
The by now unmistakable voice there of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressing the G20 summit, or G19 as he pointedly called it, via video link earlier this week. In his speech to the world leaders gathered in Indonesia, Zelensky declared that the retaking of the city of Kherson was comparable to D-Day, the Normandy landings, which marked a crucial turning point in the Second World War. So, just what is the significance, strategic and symbolic, of Kherson, and what might its liberation mean for the future course of the war? Those were questions which I put to William Alberg, Director of Strategy, Technology and Arms Control at the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
Losing Kherson was one of the most troubling parts of the early part of the war. There was a Ukrainian intelligence general who betrayed the city. So the largest city that Russia took, the collapse of the defense around there, was a real trauma in the early part of the war. And once Russia declared that entire oblast as part of Russian territory, the taking of that city became even more critical. Now that it has been taken and Russian forces have been thrown back across the Dnieper River, the chances of Russia being able to recross the Dnieper are incredibly low. This is a great position from which Ukraine can now launch attacks in the north center and the south. So there's a real possibility now that Russia could lose even more terrain. I've seen diagrams on the maps today that show that Russia might not even actually defend the Dnieper, but might actually come kilometers behind the Dnieper River, which means Ukrainian forces might even be able to cross further into their own territory, retake more territory, roll the Russians back forward. Any illusions that the Russians had that this would be a quiet winter are surely shattered now.
It is, however, a moment that is fraught with danger, as we saw on Tuesday when a missile landed on Polish soil, killing two people. The provenance of that missile wasn't immediately apparent, so there were fears that Russia might be broadening its war to provoke a direct confrontation with NATO. Could you maybe talk to me about what we've learned so far from this incident in terms of the likelihood of escalation, but also the mechanisms in place which might curb it and the willingness to react with caution?
I mean, I first think we have to look at this attack in the broader context. This was one of the most violent days of Russia's attacks on Ukraine's civilian infrastructure in the entire war. During that scale of attack, it is reasonable to expect that things will go wrong. And so Russia is taking a risk. There are lots of mechanisms, though, for NATO and for the United States to resolve issues, to deconflict. As you've seen many times so far, Secretary of Defense Austin reaches out to his counterpart quite often. General Milley also reaches out to his counterpart. The Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, who's also U.S.-European commander, he has a hotline to the Russians. So I don't think there's any real fear that something will suddenly start to click out of control without the United States and the NATO allies being able to talk to their Russian counterparts to find out what's going on and to de-escalate the situation.
Winter, as you mentioned, is coming. Post-Kherson, where are we in terms of possible exit strategies? If Zelensky's right, if we have come to a turning point in the war, how might that endgame play out?
Well, I think part of the reason Russia is doing this escalation right now, I think he's hoping that by increasing the violence against civilians, he can convince the Western countries supporting Ukraine to push Ukraine into negotiations. Because every day this war goes on now and throughout the winter, you're going to see highly motivated, increasingly better trained and armed Ukrainian soldiers going up against Russian conscripts with very low motivation, probably very poor equipment and very poor preparations for winter. So it is in Russia's interest to have a ceasefire as soon as possible in order to stop losing territory, consolidate whatever they have, and prepare for further defense or offensive actions. It's in Ukraine's interest, obviously, just to keep the battlefront moving, to keep taking territory, to keep pushing the Russians back. So this is a critical time. And again, I think Russia's probably going to continue to do terrible things in terms of civilian and civilian infrastructure in Ukraine in order to try to coerce the Ukrainians and to push the West into making the Ukrainians negotiate.
Finally, in terms of historical story arcs, there's one even greater than the one offered by Zelensky with his D-Day analogy, and that's the arc of the climate crisis. The Ukrainian delegation at COP27 drew a very, very direct link between fossil fuels and conflict, not just this conflict, but conflict in general. I was wondering if I could ask perhaps for your thoughts on that argument from a security perspective.
I think in the West, we came to the realization that being completely dependent on fossil fuel from the Middle East was a bad thing. Why we added the Middle East to that sentence is beyond me. A dependence on fossil fuel is a bad thing. And in general, states with relatively poor governance or predilection towards corruption have a high interest in extracting tremendous amounts of resources and selling them to bolster their own corruption and poor governance. It's a sort of cycle that just perpetuates itself. So the more the West, and Germany in particular, became dependent on fossil fuels from Russia, the more Germany enabled Russia to become more of an authoritarian state where the leadership, Putin himself, could extract tremendous profits from pulling resources out of the ground rather than investing in his country. Big message, fossil fuels, terrible for the environment, terrible for governance, terrible for international relations.
So if Kherson is, as Zelensky is suggesting, Ukraine's D-Day moment, potentially, could this war with Russia be the world's D-Day moment in terms of fossil fuels?
I would hope so. I mean, if this doesn't wake the world up to the idea that you can't be vulnerable to dictators for your energy, for your industry, for your heating, for your electricity, I don't know what will wake the world up.
William Alberg is Director of Strategy, Technology and Arms Control at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. For up-to-date information on the conflict in Ukraine, you can download DW's Breaking News app. The escalation of Russian shelling in western Ukraine has been felt keenly in the city of Lviv this week, which has experienced some of its worst attacks since the beginning of the war. But being under siege for most of the year hasn't stopped the city from putting itself forwards as a candidate for the award of European Youth Capital for 2025. Terry Schultz brings us this portrait of a historical city, confident in its future, despite everything.
Lights are out in Lviv, and not for the first time, as I write this story.
Russian airstrikes have hit Lviv.
Russian forces.
But the diligence of the representatives in the youth organization Tvory is undaunted by the dark. Yulia Martinyuk cheerfully answers my fact-checking questions on her phone whenever the patchy internet allows it, with 80% of the city currently lacking electricity. Yulia and her colleague Maria Pihura were part of the delegation that came to Brussels last month to make the pitch for Lviv to the European Youth Forum jury. Maria says there were some special difficulties preparing the application under fire, but also some unexpected benefits.
It's hard to get ready under the rocket attacks, but also there were the things that we are proud of. The war has shown us really a resilience and strength of our young people. Maybe we didn't expect young people to be so brave and so courageous, but it has shown us that. Maybe in this sense, it was easier for us to describe the motivation to apply for the European Youth Capital.
The Tvory team incorporated the war into their pitch, preparing a video that starts with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and talking about how motivated Ukrainian youth are to protect and rebuild their country.
We can get used to darkness.
but we'll never get used to captivity.
In fact, while it's Lviv's name on the application, Maria explains that her organization is actually coordinating the pitch on behalf of all Ukrainian cities and young people. As difficult as the situation is in Lviv, it's considered among the safest parts of Ukraine.
Lviv now is a great humanitarian hub, and there are a lot of internally displaced young people from all around Ukraine there. Yeah, that's why it's our common application, because actually it was developed by representatives of different regions of Ukraine. So that's why it's our common desire, yeah, to get the title.
The collective approach is appreciated by the European Youth Forum, the international youth platform which awards the title each year. While he emphasizes he's not expressing any opinion about Lviv's chances to win, board member Thomas Matthew notes it's the first time a city under siege has managed to apply.
They've had to adapt their program quite significantly to take into account the new situation they are in at the moment. But they've done that incredibly, and it's been inspiring to see how young people have been at the heart of their priorities, even amid the war situation that they are in. Our priority is fighting for youth rights in Europe, and war is probably one of the most blunt and violent ways in which youth rights can be violated. It's inspiring to see how young people have shown incredible courage in the most extreme of circumstances and against incredible odds.
When I visited Lviv at the end of October, street cafes were bustling and musicians were out trying to make a hryvnia or two. Except for seeing the occasional soldier in fatigues, you could almost forget you were in a country at war. Well, except perhaps for the popularity of a stand set up in a park where people paid to shoot an air gun at a picture of the Russian president.
Everybody wants to just put it.
Oksana Trelecka says she spent many happy childhood days in Lviv, 2 hours from her family home in Ivano-Frankivsk. Now she lives in Brussels, working on Ukrainian development projects. But when she and her now husband, a Spaniard, decided to get married, she knew it had to be in Lviv, and she wanted her family and friends to come. Special plans had to be made for guest safety in case of air raid alarms, which didn't happen for the 2 days of festivities.
It was truly beautiful, and most important that it was meaningful for both of us. This is a city where we first hang out as a couple.
She says they both could see themselves living there in the future, and she's keeping her fingers crossed for the opportunities the title of European Youth Capital would bring Lviv.
When you get a recognition like this, it means that what's been done is valuable, and we are moving in the right direction, and there is even more motivation to do better things.
There is that small point about Lviv being in competition with Fuenlabrada, Spain, but Oksana says she and her husband will deal with it.
Antonia is a big fan of Lviv, so I hope there is no competition here. I don't think it's going to be an issue in our marriage, but it's a funny coincidence, I would say.
The next European Youth Capital will be announced on November 23rd. Terry Schultz, DW. Lviv, Ukraine.
And you can find out more about Lviv's bid by going to the European Youth Forum website, which is at www.youthforum.org. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Finally, this half hour, we're checking in with the UK's Homes for Ukraine scheme, which is hitting some pretty serious setbacks. The British government set up the scheme in March, allowing Ukrainians to apply for a visa to live with hosts, either family members already settled in the UK or strangers who had volunteered for the role. The hosts were asked by the government to provide a home for a minimum of 6 months, a period that some of the early arrivals on the scheme are already approaching, And that's a problem, because as Bella Jewell reports from Oxford, in many cases the hosts are now considering pulling out of the scheme altogether.
We spent the first 10 days in Kyiv, constantly hearing explosions and hiding in the shelter. We didn't want to leave until we had to, but after 10 days, one evening, there was a really loud shelling and explosions right outside our home. So I asked Anna, is it time to go? And we decided, this is it. It's impossible to stay anymore.
That's Maxim. He fled Kyiv with his wife Anna and daughter Alyssa in March this year.
We really love our country and love living there. So of course we would like to go back. But the main thing to consider is the safety of our child. While there are explosions and rockets flying across the country, it doesn't seem safe to return. We'll only return when the cities are safe and peaceful.
The three of them came to live with a host family in rural Oxfordshire, along with nearly 150,000 other Ukrainians who have sought sanctuary in the UK from Russia's war.
That definitely felt like something I am able to do, and it shouldn't take too much out of me to do it.
You just heard Maria, Anna, Maxim and Alyssa's host mother. She's from Russia originally, but works as a teacher in the UK with her husband David. Signing up as a host was her way of helping alleviate the suffering caused by a war that her family support.
My family are very strong supporters of Putin, unfortunately. So they were very much pro-war and they thought that's an excellent idea.
I'd known that Masha was really having a hard time of it. Very quickly, I worked out that this was something we could do and that I thought would be a good idea.
Maria and David's decision was not an easy one. It meant not only creating space in their home for strangers, but also sacrificing Maria's relationship with her parents.
It was very difficult. We basically stopped talking for a while during the months, several months after the invasion. Every conversation would lead to politics very swiftly, and it would be a big argument, and it would get very personal. There would be shouting involved and some swear words, and generally lots of unkindness towards me because I'm on the other side.
These two families are making co-living work for them. But for many other Ukrainians here, the situation is not so stable. And there's a real risk that some could face being displaced again over the winter months. It's all down to the structure of the UK government's Homes to Ukraine and Ukraine Family Schemes, which rely on hosts to sponsor Ukrainians. Lidia Vinogradna is a blogger living in Milton Keynes. She fled Kyiv back in April and now lives and works in the UK with her young daughter and mother.
I understood that most Ukrainians don't have a clue of what they should be doing. So I started a blog, GovUK, etc. Sometimes they use quite complicated ways of expressing themselves. I can describe in simple words difficult things. And that's how I can help Ukrainians here in UK.
Now she advises her 30,000 followers on how to settle into life here, navigating the benefits system and the government's Ukraine schemes. We met, albeit virtually, and she explains how hosting arrangements can and do fall apart.
Actually, there's no commitment. Tomorrow, they can ask Ukrainians to move out, and Ukrainians have to move out. There's no contractual obligations.
When host families here accept guests, they're asked to host for a minimum of 6 months. But there is no contract binding them to that. And then there's the question of what happens to their guests when that period is over. The government publishes regular data on Ukrainians facing homelessness using information sent to them by some local councils.
That's very hard to say that it is a very representative survey to speak about. But overall, there are, I think, around 1,000 families face the issues. But, I mean, taking into account 100,000 Ukrainians based in UK or more, I think. So this is not a bigger percentage.
But even if it's a relatively small percentage, it's still a huge problem for these families, often with children who are suddenly plunged into crisis. Lydia points out that the Ukraine Family Scheme doesn't pay the hosts an allowance of £350 per month, which has resulted in some Ukrainians ending up in temporary accommodation.
It can be like a hostel without any kitchen. The worst thing is that they can stay there for months and they can be moved from one temporary accommodation to a different one. And especially if you have children, this is a very, very difficult situation.
There are many reasons that a hosting arrangement could fall apart, and money at a time like this is clearly one of them.
A currency collapse, soaring borrowing rates, investors and businesses in despair. And that in just the span of a week.
Dr. Alex Powell is a lecturer at Oxford Brookes University and specialises in refugee and human rights law.
We think in the context of the cost of living crisis we're now seeing, it's quite likely that some host families might feel that actually bringing three or four people into their house is not a good idea at this time, and the payment no longer sort of covers any extra costs they would incur.
Back on a hot August afternoon, I spoke to Christina Schmalenbach, the programme manager for the Homes for Ukraine support team at the local charity Asylum Welcome. She estimated that in Oxfordshire, the council would need to rehome a large number of Ukrainians as hosts approach the six-month mark.
From the amount of current hosts, at the moment, we do not think that half of them would want to continue into the future.
But it's not just the hosts that struggle with co-living arrangements. Christina is in contact with many of the county's Ukrainian guests.
They are very grateful. They appreciate the help that they've been given. But the ones that we hear about, they yearn for some independence, life on their own, where they don't have to tiptoe around someone else's space. And who cannot understand that?
Both Lydia and Christina emphasise the importance of hosts and guests having honest and open conversations about the future. And that's something that Maria has made sure to do with Anna and Maxim. She's set them the goal of a year to move out into rented accommodation.
I don't think it's unreasonable to expect that in a year's time you will build towards it, but also I understand that there are some certain concerns. Even if by the end of this year they can't basically be somewhere, we're not going to kick them out, but we will try to re-emphasize that we're expecting you to start earning money, looking for a place. And I think that needs to be a very clear message what the expectations are from each side.
But for some families, there are obstacles in the way of getting work and moving into rented accommodation. Here's Lydia again.
Every person has a different situation. So the most vulnerable people are those who have children and don't know English.
And there's a longer-term problem. In the UK, Ukrainians are not legally classed as refugees. Instead, they receive a three-year visa. So what will happen when their visas expire? Dr. Alex Powell again.
3 years is not long enough to claim indefinite leave to remain, for example. It's not long enough to make any claims to permanent residence. I suspect that's rather deliberate. You may well see people transitioning from the Homes for Ukraine scheme into refugee status. You would also hope that if the conflict is still ongoing, the UK government would meaningfully respond and would also obviously be in communication with those who come to the UK so that their anxiety is not building.
It's hard to say just how many Ukrainians will need rehousing in the coming months or how long they'll need to stay in the UK. But it's clear that many of them are anxious. Here's Anna again.
The life you're living now is just a placeholder while you're waiting to go back to your life. When you see buildings being bombed and children dying, it feels like part of your soul, your old life, is dying with it. We're sitting here watching our lives and our country crumble bit by bit, and we're unable to get back to it.
Bella Jewell, DW, Oxford.
The British Red Cross provides information for Ukrainian refugees in English, Ukrainian and Russian. Go to their webpages to find out more. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Thank you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Coming up in the next half hour, after the bomb attack, major fallout in Istanbul and beyond. Boost your toot. German social media site Mastodon steps in to fill the Twitter breach. Matter of principle, why the World Cup won't be showing in some Norwegian pubs.
We found out it's easy to be against something when it doesn't cost you anything. When we all believe that a boycott actually could work, we decided to chip in that money and stand for something, actually.
Plus, NFL on tour. American football comes to Germany.
Broadcasting from Germany. This is Inside Europe.
Turkey is still coming to terms with a deadly bombing which tore through the heart of a busy shopping street in Istanbul last Sunday, killing 6 and injuring 80 people. Within hours, the security forces claimed to have arrested a woman bomber who they say is linked to Kurdish militants backed by the United States. As Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, there's already considerable diplomatic and political fallout from the attack.
Mourners continue to lay flowers at the site of Sunday's deadly bombing in Istanbul's most famous shopping street. The attack killed 6, including a mother and daughter and a father and son, and dozens were injured. Shop owners clear up the devastation and, like the rest of the city, are trying to come to terms with this latest attack. A shopkeeper, Lokman Kalkan, explains.
It was a disaster. People were fighting for their lives. There was screaming and crying and blood everywhere. There was nothing we could do.
While the country grieves for the dead, the political repercussions are already being felt. Security forces, after detaining the alleged bomber just hours after the attack, claim it was carried out by the Kurdish militant group, the PKK, a charge it denies. The PKK is fighting the Turkish state for greater minority rights. But Devlet Bahçeli, leader of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's parliamentary coalition partner, the MHP, called Tuesday for the closure of Turkey's legal Kurdish party, the HDP.
Türkiye Büyük Millet Meclisi'nde bölücü sima istemiyoruz.
We don't want to see separatists in parliament. We cannot stand seeing terrorists. We cannot tolerate the HDP for even a second.
The HDP is already facing a closure case, with many of its parliamentary deputies in jail over links to the PKK. Those convictions have been widely condemned as politically motivated by the European Court of Human Rights. And the bombing fallout is threatening to further strain US-Turkish relations. The police allege the bomber was trained by the Syrian Kurdish militia, the YPG, which Ankara says is affiliated with the PKK. Washington backs the Syrian Kurdish group in its fight against the Islamic State. Turkish Interior Minister Süleyman Soylu, speaking at the site of the bombing, said there was a need to reconsider Turkish-American relations.
We reject the condolences of the American embassy. We do not accept them. Our alliance with a state that sends money from its own Senate to these groups, feeding the terror zones in northern Syria, which aim to disturb Turkey's peace, is a controversial situation. This is open and clear.
Senen Aydın Duzgit of the Istanbul Policy Center says there is a large audience in Turkey for such anti-American rhetoric.
You have the Americans' alliance with the Kurds in northern Syria, so there is this perception that America is in alliance with the PKK and the Kurdish nationalist movement, and that sort of creates hostility as well. There is a lot of anti-Americanism in Turkey as well. Some of it historical, ideological, you know, because you have anti-Americanism both on the right and also on the left of the political spectrum. And this is not just something that's sort of unique to the right wing of the political spectrum, but the left suffers from it as well.
Any diplomatic fallout between Ankara and Washington appears contained, at least for now, with Erdogan meeting US President Joe Biden on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Indonesia. But analysts suggest The real fallout could be next year's presidential election. With Erdogan and his AKP party languishing in the polls, teacher of international relations, Soli Özel, at Istanbul's Kadir Has University, says Sunday's bombing stokes fears history could be repeating itself.
Well, on the 7th of June, the AKP lost its absolute majority in the parliament. An alternative government could not be formed. So we went to a repeat election. And in between that period of time, starting in mid-July, violence escalated. There were terrorist incidents. And one of the most awful terrorist incidents in the country's history, with the largest number of deaths, also took place only 20 days before the repeat election took place in Ankara.
Erdogan won the November 2015 election with a large majority. Opposition parties are already raising questions over the investigation into the Sunday bombing, particularly the speed of the inquiry and its swift conclusions. That scrutiny is likely to grow, given the high political stakes, as many in the country look towards next year's election with increasing foreboding. Doreen Jones, DW, Istanbul.
For more of our coverage from Turkey and other countries across the continent, you can subscribe to our podcast, which is available on all the usual podcast platforms. For the latest on world events as they happen, download DW's Breaking News app. Now, it's no secret that things have been a little bumpy at Twitter lately. 1 million Twitter users have left the microblogging and social media network service since October 27th. That's the date on which the deal was sealed on billionaire Elon Musk's controversial and tumultuous takeover. Many of those users have relocated to a site called Mastodon, created in 2016 by a German software developer who, until recently, was the site's only employee and who one imagines is not getting very much sleep at the moment. In order to find out more about Mastodon, I contacted Chris Kerver, a journalist and editor at Netzpolitik.org, a German online publication specialising in digital democracy issues. To my surprise, I found out that Chris is herself a Mastodon newbie.
Yeah, I'm one of those people. So I have to say, to sort of for the credit of my colleagues, that a lot of people on our team have already been on Mastodon for quite a while. But I'm one of those people, I don't have a super like hacking, or I'm not in the Chaos Computer Club. And I'm also one of the people who tend to be quite lazy when it comes to using open source software, open alternatives. I just need this nudge. And I think, like with a lot of other people, this was the nudge. The whole thing that is happening at Twitter right now since Musk took over the platform is the nudge that I needed to actually be like, okay, this might be a little different, but this is exactly the right moment to try it out.
I'd like you to take me step by step through the process that you've been through in terms of setting up your account in a second. But just sort of for people who don't know, what is Mastodon and how is it different to Twitter?
So Mastodon is a social media service. The major difference to Twitter and to many other social media platforms is that it's not owned by any one person and it's not a commercial business, right? So it's a decentralized platform. The idea is that instead of having like a central company or instance running everything, there's these different servers where you can sign up. And they are connected to each other. So once you have an account on one of these servers, you can interact with anybody else who has a Mastodon account, no matter what server they're in. And I think that was one of the things that really appealed to me and that makes it very special is, if you think about the downtown, like commercialized typical downtown in Berlin or any other big city, everything is commercialized. There's hard to find a space where you can even sit without having to pay for a coffee. You can see advertising everywhere. But then all of a sudden, right next to it, you see this community garden that is just there. And no one is trying to sell you anything. No one is advertising to you. You don't have to pay anything to get in. And that's kind of a bit what Mastodon is in this universe of commercial social media platforms that we see, where, you know, the whole business model is to grab our data, catch as much data about us as users as a platform can possibly collect and make us into these marketable profiles that then can be sold to advertisers. Mastodon is not commercial. No one is trying to make any money with it. And I think that makes it very, very special in today's social media setting that we see.
Well, you now have your own little piece of that garden because you have your own Mastodon account finally. How did you do it? And what decisions were you confronted with along the way?
So one of the first things that you have to decide is where to sort of make your home. So because it's not a centralized platform, you have to decide what instance you will sign up on.
Right. Hang on. An instance. You're going to have to explain that one. There's a lot of terminology with Mastodon, isn't there?
Exactly. So if you think about it in this decentralized way, it's kind of like these different pods. So someone will voluntarily set up a server because your data will have to be somewhere, right? You cannot be free floating on the internet. So there needs to be a server where your account is located, where you're setting up your account. And these servers are called instances, and they can be run by different people. Some of them are run by political parties, or some will be run by scientific institutions. But it could also just be some person volunteering to provide the server, and then you can sign up to it.
I have to come clean here and say that I tried to set up a Mastodon account and I actually stumbled at this hurdle because I was confronted with a whole lot of sort of personal responsibility that I wasn't used to. Because I was actively choosing a server, I wanted to research who it was that was moderating the server, whether I could, you know, feel comfortable with their values. Like there was a whole sort of load of personal research and personal responsibility that was being put onto me.
Yeah, you're right. It's probably a good idea to do this research, right? Because you want to end up on a server where you know that, for instance, moderation rules will be quite strict, that racism, sexism, so on, will be strictly moderated. So I do think it's a good idea. And I think also it's part of the idea of using Mastodon to take a little bit more of this responsibility. I wouldn't let this keep you from signing up because it can be overwhelming. And I for instance, didn't know that it's not a permanent decision. So you could set up your account on an instance. And then if you realize it's maybe not for you, you want to move somewhere else, you can move to another instance and take all your followers with you.
So what happens if you have a server that is set up by somebody or a political party even with the express intention of spewing hate? What happens there in a decentralized network without moderators?
It is not unmoderated. The problem, however, is that Mastodon is mostly run by volunteers, right? So with the exception of a few ministries or state organizations that run servers, the moderators are also volunteers. And the question is always, what will happen when the volume of content is just going up? Will they be able to keep moderating? However, I read that Mastodon says that it will delist servers that do not apply to certain rules. So if servers do not, for instance, say that we will actually moderate racist content, sexist content, at least try to do that, they will not be listed in central directories. So this is already happening.
I was wondering whether it's an accident that this kind of software came out of Germany, or whether there is something about the German relationship towards digital democracy, digital privacy, and so on that is perhaps different to that of the United States.
Yeah, I don't think it's an accident. There's actually a very strong community of people who are working in open source software, and this is also an open source project. So I can imagine that it's not a coincidence, but that it actually has something to do with there is already a strong community here. There is certainly a long tradition of people who have been very skeptical about giving their data and what happens with their data. So I do think that certainly plays into it.
Chris Kerver is an editor at netzpolitik.org, specializing in privacy and digital rights. Her Mastodon handle is @ckerver@home.social. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany, and you're listening to Inside Europe.
not on Mastodon, but you can find us on Spotify, Pocket Cast, Apple Podcasts, Player FM, and many more podcast platforms. And now for a spot of sports journalism. That is not something that you hear very often on Inside Europe. But with the Football World Cup about to kick off in Qatar on Sunday, we thought we'd better cover it. Although I warn you, in Europe, the enthusiasm is muted at best this year. Several European cities have said they will not be showing matches on big screens in public places. And, as Lars Bavanger reports from Oslo, some fans are now considering whether or not to bother watching any of the matches at all.
Norwegians are as football mad as anybody. In fact, one in 15 Norwegians count themselves as active players across more than 27,000 football teams. And even though the Norwegian national team has not played in the World Cup since 1998, the competition is a huge deal, usually.
But the mood is definitely different this time around. Early last year, before Norway failed to qualify, the Norwegian Football Federation considered a boycott of the tournament. This was voted down, but now some here have taken matters into their own hands, like this popular football pub in central Oslo.
And the first time we debated it, it was only one of six that wanted to do a boycott. So the idea of a boycott have actually...
That's Frode Lia, a board member of Ball Football Pub, which has decided not to show any World Cup matches this year. Why?
Well, the simple answer is the number of people dead. Especially after the report from Amnesty International, this became a debate in our board. It's also like a mini protest about the modern football. Sports washing and amount of money, Saudi money into Premier League and so on. So it's also a little protest against that.
Human rights organisations and media have long been reporting on Qatar's failure to protect its 2 million strong migrant workforce, with many deaths linked to the construction of World Cup infrastructure. Qatar also bans homosexuality and women's rights are severely curtailed. But what, if anything, will switching the TV off do to improve things?
And Maradona gives Argentina the lead.
I've been following the World Cup since 1986. It's the greatest and the best sports event in the world, and it has been ever since.
Norwegian football fan Sindre Tollefsen is a fierce defender of human rights, but he will watch the matches when things kick off on Sunday. It's not been an easy decision, though.
It will be a bittersweet experience, and I will feel there is less dissonance or ambivalence during the matches, no doubt. I think the strongest thing you can do is use your own voice and being just critical during the whole World Cup. I think actually Qatari and FIFA accounts on social media will try to respond to football fans. So we know that the PR strategies are more and more important for every authoritarian government around the world, and especially now the Qatari government, and that they're very, very sensitive to public criticism. So if there can be thousands of football supporters using social media channels and their own accounts to really give that kind of criticism, I think that has got more of an effect.
So what about the regulars at Ball Football Pub in Oslo? Some applaud the boycott, others say they will watch at home or go to other pubs. This time, however, there are also other reasons why things feel very different.
It doesn't feel like an upcoming World Cup, since it's also November.
Yeah. Will you be watching skiing instead, maybe?
Maybe winter sports, yeah, of course. But I won't deny that I might watch a few games, since you have the national broadcaster showing it, which is also quite a dilemma in a way. When you know the backstory with the slave type conditions, even though you have the like theoretical improvements for workers, there's not practical improvements really at all. So it's a terrible decision.
Do you think it makes a difference that a football club chooses not to show the matches?
I don't think it's going to change the world, to be honest. But I think I support it as well. It's nice to make a decision like that that isn't only about commercial interests, but also about doing something right.
The Qatari government has called much of the criticism levied at the country false. FIFA, World Football's governing body, says it remains in positive continuing dialogue with labour organisations and Qatari authorities over initiatives that will benefit migrant workers in Qatar, also after the World Cup.
If only 2, 3, 4, 5% of Europeans are going to boycott the World Cup.
Meanwhile, Frudelia and the other board members at Bull Football Pub have laid plenty of alternative plans, which they hope will both entertain and educate their customers.
We're going to show some old World Cups, actually. The German 2006 World Cup, for example. We are going to host a lot of seminars here. Amnesty International is going to have a seminar here, talking about human rights. But even though we are going to have other arrangements here, we are going to lose money for not showing the World Cup. But we found out it's easy to be against something when it doesn't cost you anything. When we all believe that a boycott actually could work, we decided to chip in that money and stand for something, actually.
And does he worry the regulars will not return when this World Cup is over?
They will come back. We are the greatest football bar in Oslo, so they will come back.
Lars Bevanger, DW, Oslo.
If you've grown weary of the beautiful game, you could always try swapping football for American football, or if you're an American, soccer for football. And if that wasn't confusing enough, our next report is on the US NFL, National Football League's first ever regular season game on German soil, where football, or soccer, is called Fußball. Anyway, the much-anticipated game between the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and the Seattle Seahawks took place 3 months ahead of the Super Bowl, the NFL championship game, which is the biggest single sporting event in the world. Our reporter, Ben Batke, was at the game in Munich's Allianz Arena.
It's so great to be here in Munich, 32 years after I start playing football. Feel the atmosphere, it's unbelievable, the fans are crazy, they're getting so loud, it will be an awesome game.
When the NFL finally touched down in Germany, more than three decades after his American football journey began, Jens Ellemann was in the middle of the action. The NFL's first ever regular season game in Germany was above all a huge fan fest and a rollicking celebration of American football, a sport known for spectacular tackles, touchdowns and tailgating. For many fans in Munich, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers beating the Seattle Seahawks 21-16 was almost secondary. But there were also many diehard fans like Ellemann who are loyal to one team. The 16-time Ironman triathlete's heart has been beating for the Buccaneers for 27 years.
When I was 18, I grabbed some money. We traveled over to Florida to grab some games. We watched high school, Friday Night Lights, college football, and then the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. It was so amazing to be in this stadium now 56th time. It's 27 years, and it will be going on and on and on.
Andrea Tryon is the mother of one of the players on the Buccaneers squad. Yeah! She was one of the many Americans who traveled to Germany specifically for the game.
Joseph Tryon-Shoyinka, number 9, outside linebacker for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He had a sack on the opening drive of the game. First game in Germany is very exciting for everybody from the United States. Bucket list trip. Go Bucs!
A sack is when a defensive player tackles the opponent's quarterback, which usually gets the crowd fired up.
Joe Tryon-Shoyinka with the sack.
Tryon-Shoyinka was the Buccaneers' first choice at last year's NFL draft when teams select the best young players for the year. During this year's draft back in April, superfan Ellemann was given the privilege of announcing one of the Buccaneers' picks live from inside Allianz Arena.
Servus from Munich.
All of Deutschland is excited to have the two-time Super Bowl champion playing right here. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers select Kate Otten, tight end, Washington. Go Bucs and raise the flags.
On that day, the stands were empty. But last Sunday, Ellermann was one of almost 70,000 football fans who turned Germany's second largest soccer stadium into a football temple that rivals famous NFL arenas like the ones of the Kansas City Chiefs, the Pittsburgh Steelers, or the Green Bay Packers. The NFL is the most commercially successful sports league in the world. In 2019, it brought in $15 billion in revenue. That's close to three times more than the UK's Premier League. According to Forbes, 11 of the 25 most valuable sports teams in the world are NFL franchises. And Germany is a key market for the NFL's global expansion plans, mainly because of the country's large and growing NFL fan base. That wasn't the case when Ellermann started playing football in the late 80s.
When I was 13, we are totally outsiders. Nobody cares about it. You're playing football. You mean you're playing soccer? No. Football, American football, you always have to explain it. Nobody knows the sport. It takes a long time to get it growth, and now it grows to such a big sport in Germany.
Just how big? The NFL says it could have sold more than 3 million tickets for the Munich game. Despite its mass appeal, the NFL is not without its own controversies. For example, former quarterback Colin Kaepernick's kneeling protest and his subsequent collusion lawsuit against the NFL is considered a black mark against the league. Most recently, quarterback Deshaun Watson was temporarily suspended after more than 20 women accused him of sexual assault during massage appointments. None of this seemed to be on anyone's mind in Munich, though. Inside the stadium, it was all smiles, colorful jerseys, and extravagant fan gear. And it wasn't just the red and white Buccaneers and the white and blue Seahawks on show. Fans were wearing the colors of virtually all of the NFL's 32 teams. However, one jersey stood out among the rest, a Buccaneers jersey with the number 12 on it. It's the number of Tom Brady, the most successful and most famous player in the history of the sport. The 45-year-old has won the Super Bowl a record 7 times.
That was one of the great football experiences I've ever had. The fan turnout was incredible. It felt very electric from the time we took the field. At the end of the game, with them singing Sweet Caroline and Country Road, that was pretty epic.
And it felt like a real concert when fans turned on their mobile phone flashlights and lighters as the players on the field lined up for the next play. For many people, it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. It seems that the NFL is here to stay. Over the next 3 years, three more regular season games will be played in Munich and Frankfurt. Buccaneers superfan Jens Ellermann thinks that if the exuberant atmosphere at this very first Germany game was any indication, the future of American football around here is bright.
My football experience comes now to a full circle. Great atmosphere in the stadiums, fans from all around the world with all their different jerseys, rooting for some teams. Unbelievable how many people want to come this game, relaying in at each other's arms. We know they're coming back for three more games, but hopefully they keep it up and maybe bring some more games in here.
Ben Bartke, DW Munich.
Well, you know what they say, it was a show of two halves. That's it for today. This program was produced by Helen Sini with help from Nick Martin and me, Kate Laycock. The sound engineer was a very jealous NFL fan, Thomas Schmidt. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.